Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today, what I'm going to do is give you a military history lesson, and I'm going to show you how the past and the future come together. That lessons from the past are relevant in the future right now. And what we're going to do is we're going to study the upcoming Ukrainian storm, because this thing is now upon us. This thing has actually begun. The preparatory moves have already taken place, and this thing is going to turn into the wildest storm you've ever seen. And I want you to understand this clearly, because crazy things are going to happen in the next couple of months. And these things are massive. They are the biggest things since World War II. And there is so much that you can learn from this, and you will understand all sorts of things which are very important for all whites, especially white men, to know everywhere. And I really am running behind on other military stuff, especially my Gods of War series. But we'll bring in some of the Gods of War to quickly show you a few things that come from the past, but which relate immediately to what you're seeing here in the news and what's going to unfold. Because I had been wondering, how big is the Ukrainian offensive going to be? How effective is it going to be? And now I'm absolutely staggered by what I'm starting to realize, and I want to show it to you, because this thing is massive, it's hectic, and it's going to come onto the world news so quietly. People are not even going to notice this thing, and a freaking wild storm is going to burst onto the world's news scene, and people are going to be stunned by what's about to happen. And it's very important that I explain things to you up front so that you know, so that you begin to grasp a lot of what's happening behind the scenes that's been hidden from you, so that as this thing comes into the open, that you actually appreciate and grasp what has been going on here. So today we're going to do a history lesson, and we're going to look at the past and the future, and you are going to see in the coming months how this history lesson comes to life. And crazy, wild things are going to appear, and you'll be able to sit back and grasp everything that's happening. So what I'm going to start with is a very quick little summary, just a very quick summary to give you some background. And while I do that, there's this map on the screen. And at the moment, this map is empty, but you can take a look at that map. That is the part of the Ukraine that is occupied by the Russians currently. So you can see the areas that the Russians hold, and in the further south is Crimea, which Putin seized in 2014. And as we progress through this, I'm going to be showing you stuff, and that map is going to start coming alive. And I'm going to explain a ton of things for you on that map, and then you're going to have that as a reference when the storm comes. And let me tell you, I wasn't sure how big the storm is going to be. Now I think the storm is going to be freaking huge, and you're going to see something like you've never seen in your life. And when this is over, you're going to appreciate what white men can do when they are armed and they're motivated, and what they can pull off. You're going to see a battle unlike anything you've seen in your life. So, a little quick summary of background stuff. Looking back on February, where I thought that maybe the Russians might be able to advance a bit and then get bogged down again, the Russians were totally unable to advance. All advances in Bakhmut were totally pathetic, utterly useless. The ability of the Ukrainians to hold the Russians back has been incredible. The front lines are literally rock solid, and we are on the edge of a Ukrainian counteroffensive. The first indications are already appearing that the Ukrainians are starting to move with some kind of counteroffensive. There are Ukrainians who've crossed the river near Kherson. They have already taken over an area, a 20-kilometer frontage. There are other signs that the Ukrainians are getting ready to fight. We don't know exactly when. From what I can pick up, the Ukrainians have got six brigades prepared already. Six brigades were ready for combat at the end of March. Three more brigades are being trained. They're going to be ready sometime in May. That gives the Ukrainians nine brigades. The Ukrainians have got a total of 40,000 troops who've been training like crazy for months. So they got 40,000 troops with the latest weaponry, and they're going to try to break through somewhere. I took a quick look at the maps. Everybody is pointing to the area in Zaporizhia, but I was looking at the extremes. I was looking at the extremes. To me, the extremes made much more sense. The one is Kherson itself, because Kherson is on a road straight into Crimea. The other one that I like quite a lot is Mariupol. The other possibility is the one that everybody says is impossible. Everybody says it's impossible to go south of Kherson, that there's lots of problems with why you wouldn't want to go south of Kherson. You've got bridges that can be blown, you've got marshy ground, etc. But history is actually filled with many examples of brilliant campaigns and battles that were fought by having an army move across terrain or attack in a place where nobody thinks it's possible. Where people look at this terrain and they say it's totally impossible to fight there, it's a waste of time. And then somebody has come and they've attacked in exactly that place and the other side has totally crumbled. So when I look at the map and everybody keeps saying Zaporizhia, Zaporizhia and so forth, and I'm looking at Zaporizhia and all those lines and the Luhansk Oblast and all that. When I look at it, to me, it looks like there's only two real places. If I look at it, to me, it's like there are only two real places, and both of them are at extremes. The one is south of Kherson, straight into Crimea. The other one is Mariupol. So I reckon in the next 4 to 8 weeks, we're going to start seeing those tanks going into action. We're going to start seeing if that special 40,000 man, 9 brigade armored force, if that armored force can actually slice through the Russian lines somewhere. The real thing that we have to watch is to see how good are the Ukrainians. There is one American general who thinks that the war can be won in 1 to 2 years. He thinks the war can be won in 1 to 2 years if the Ukrainians get all the stuff. Okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at some film footage. There are lots of people on the white right who listen to Douglas McGregor and Scott Ritter, and I know their history, and I know that they have been honest and they've told the truth in the past, and they've got quite a name for themselves as a result of their past. And they're also experienced soldiers, etc. and they've dealt with the Russians and so forth. So I have gone from time to time and I've listened to Douglas McGregor, especially to Colonel Douglas McGregor, especially, and I've listened to what he's had to say. And I've listened in to odd moments of Scott Ritter. And these two are very much in agreement with each other. So this piece of film footage that you're going to see is 5 minutes long, and you're going to get a chance to hear Scott Ritter commenting on Douglas McGregor's statements, and he is going to be totally in agreement with Douglas McGregor. So you're going to hear some of what Douglas McGregor is saying out of Scott Ritter's mouth, and Scott Ritter is going to tell you, this guy's totally right. This is what's going on. So listen to that because I'm going to comment afterwards. And take special note, once you've listened to Scott Ritter, even if you have to stop the video, sit back and think for a second about the message that has hit you. This message that has hit you. What is he saying and how is it impacting your mind and your emotions? What are you walking away with after you've listened to Scott Ritter on this show?
The Ukrainian people are being slaughtered, and we don't, we're mad that our tax money is going to them versus helping the homeless or whatever, but their reality is that they are being wiped out as a nation. What are your thoughts on him saying that this has now become a humanitarian crisis for Ukraine?
Well, I'll preface this by saying that Colonel McGregor is one of the few sane voices out there, and every time he speaks, there's that old commercial when I forget the name of the company, but when so and so speaks, everybody listens. When Colonel McGregor speaks, everybody should listen because he is very, very balanced, and I have to second what he's saying. It is a humanitarian. We're watching the death of a nation. Literally the death of a nation, but more than that, we're watching the death of a people. I don't mean individuals. I mean the Ukrainian people. If the casualty figures are remotely correct, and I believe they are, over 300,000 Ukrainian men have died. Right? That's a genetic pool that is gone, removed. I don't want to get into, too much, but understand that, we all know where we came from, and it wasn't storks. Okay, and it requires a man and a woman in union to produce children. And the Ukrainians are losing their men. They're being slaughtered. And again, I don't want to get into too much Darwinism here, but some of the best examples of Ukrainian men, the most healthy, most physically fit, manly men are dying. And so what's left is not that. What's left is something different, which is going to change the way Ukraine moves forward as a nation. This is wrong. This is just we and most Americans don't get it. They're being slaughtered. It's not a fair fight. Now, no war is meant to be. Colin Powell famously said, "I don't believe in a fair fight. My job isn't to have a fair fight. My job is to kill you." And that's what the Russians are doing right now. They have, over the course of the last several months, changed the entire dynamic of this war zone. Ukrainian air defense almost doesn't exist anymore. And by removing air defense on the front line, the Russian Air Force is now freer to attack targets using weapons they previously couldn't do. Ukrainian weapons that were given to them by the United States, designed to equalize the battlefield, no longer work because the Russians are very smart, very adaptive. They've jammed the GPS signals. And so the Ukrainians aren't able to do to the Russians what the Russians are doing to them in increasing numbers. And the Russians are gradually getting angry. And what I mean by that is their capacity to kill is becoming greater. Whereas during the Battle of Mariupol, the Russians did not habitually drop entire apartment buildings. They would actually send their troops in who would fight floor by floor by floor to take the building, very bloody fighting. And then they, give the people in the basement a chance to surrender. Now the Russians come forward, and the Ukrainians have turned an apartment block into a fortified zone. They pull back, and they drop a 1,500-pound bomb on it and drop the whole building, killing everybody inside. They're doing that over and over again. The Ukrainians used to be able to assemble troops about 15 kilometers behind the front line, concentrate them before sending them in to fight as a coherent force. Now, as they assemble them, the Russians are detecting it, and they're dropping the 1,500-pound bomb right on those troops, killing everybody. The Ukrainians can't concentrate their forces. Their artillery is being destroyed piecemeal by drones that are operating freely without any interference. And the Ukrainians are running out of artillery ammunition, so they can't even defend their troops in the trenches. And trench warfare is hell, excuse my language. It is a living hell. This war, I mean, war is, again, Tecumseh Sherman said it, war is hell. I forget there was another general that said, thank goodness a war is so bad as it is because we grow to love it. Maybe Ulysses Grant said that, but this is all true. We know this, but this is a special kind of hell. This is Dante's Inferno 20 times over for the Ukrainian soldiers. And to be blunt, we're to blame. The American people are to blame because we have allowed our government to create this situation. This war is happening because of American policies, only because of American policies. And we have poured so much money and so much material into this war. We've kept it going longer than it naturally should have. This war should have been over a long time ago. Ukraine was never going to win this war. Russia was always going to win this war. What we've done is prolonged this conflict, ensuring that hundreds of thousands of more Ukrainians die. Tens of millions of Ukrainians are displaced. Homes are destroyed. Cities are destroyed. Towns are destroyed. And all the while, we're balancing on the precipice of a nuclear conflict that could put us at risk as well. But McGregor is 100% correct. This is a humanitarian disaster. And the best thing we could do is bring an end to it. And the easiest way to end this war is to cut off the supplies to Ukraine and force them to go to the negotiating table. They're on life support right now. And all we're doing is pumping, artificially, stimulated life into a body that shouldn't be alive. We need to unplug it, get it done, and let Ukraine move on and try and recover as much as they can.
So after you've listened to Scott Ritter, what do you walk away with? Well, you're going to walk away with this feeling that the Ukrainians are just being slaughtered like dogs, that the Ukrainians are dying left, right, and center, and that the Russians are okay. The Russians are okay. The Russians are just killing and slaughtering all the Ukrainian men, and there's going to be no Ukrainian men left when this is over, and that victory is inevitable for the Russians. The Russians are going to win. The Russians cannot lose. The Russians are going to win. And that all that has happened is that stupid America has gone and pumped weaponry in. The weaponry has gone into Ukraine. And all that this is doing is that it is prolonging the life of Ukraine needlessly. That Ukraine is actually destined to lose totally. That it doesn't stand any hope in hell. It is like somebody that is busy dying in a hospital, and all you're doing is prolonging their life for a time. They are suffering and they're gonna die. And by prolonging their life, they are gonna be worse off than if you'd just pulled the plug immediately. Just pull the plug and let them die, because it's so much more humane. You should have just left them so that the Russians come and knock them out quickly, and then it's over. Then the Russians have won, and the Ukrainians have to learn to live under Russian rule. and that is much better for them. That is the gist of what you're hearing here, and that the West has now created this bloody conflict, made it worse than it would have been. Just leave the Ukrainians to die. It's so much better for the Ukrainians. I must tell you that I went and started listening to Colonel Douglas McGregor with an open mind when I was told, listen, that guy's got information, he knows stuff, and he's telling it like it is. So I went and I started watching some of Douglas McGregor's interviews where he's talking. And I'm listening to his facts and I'm taking his facts in. It is very clear for me from my perspective here in Southern Africa, where we've had lots of conflicts around us for decades. It was very clear to me right at the outset that especially Douglas McGregor, but also Scott Ritter, that these two guys have got contacts with Russians. They've got direct Russian military contacts that they are talking to. That was very, very obvious to me. But then I thought to myself, okay, that's cool. They're talking to Russians. They've got some kind of link to Russian military people. These Russian military people are feeding them information. Let's listen to what the Russians have to say. And I was just taking in the information. But then there came a time where Douglas McGregor started to make certain statements. He started saying things like, the Ukrainians are running out of men. He started saying the Ukrainians are running out of men, that they now have to go and grab the boys off the streets, that there are no men left, that they got to go and grab boys off the streets and throw them into the Ukrainian army. They're just going to die shortly anyway, but they're running out of men. There are no men left, okay? Now, I am very, very interested in military stuff, and you're going to see something that I'm going to be producing shortly that I want to finish off that I've been working on for months, and you'll see how serious I am about military stuff, because I'm very, very fascinated by military calculations, actual calculations of battle outcomes. That is an area that fascinates me tremendously. So when this war started, one of the very first things I wanted to establish, I wanted to know, what is the ratio between the deaths of Ukrainian men and the deaths of Russian men? Which side is superior in combat to the other one? And of course, there's lots of lying, lots of deception, etc. But I came to this conclusion. My conclusion was that at the very least, one Ukrainian is dying for one Russian. At the very least. However, I think that more Russians are dying per Ukrainian than the other way around. That if one Ukrainian dies, that maybe 1.5 Russians die, maybe 2 Russians die. I was willing to settle for that. That one Ukrainian dies and 1 or even 2 Russians die. That was my conclusion. The next thing I did at different points in this conflict was I tried to see from various sides and various publications how many people had been injured, how many had been killed in the army. And while the conflict is very intensive, it is not a total slaughterhouse where everyone's going to be wiped out. There was anything from 300 men being killed or injured every day to 1,000 men being killed or injured every day. So yeah, those numbers are kind of freaky. But they are freaky to us in this day and age. I can show you in history where white men have fought battles going back into the times of the Romans where many more than that were killed in a single day. You'd be horrified how intensive past wars have been that white men have fought, where 80,000 men could be killed in one day. I'm not joking with you. 80,000 white men would be killed in a single day. They wouldn't be injured, they'd be dead. So white men have fought very intensive conflicts, with an intensity that will shock you, even in this day and age. You won't believe what men were capable of with swords, with cannons, etc. White men have fought with levels of intensity that will shock you. Your jaws will drop if you realized how intensive our race can fight a war. And this is in the age before there were machine guns, before there were air forces, etc. But the difference is that in modern warfare is that the conflict runs for days, weeks, and months with non-stop fighting. Whereas in those times, they would maneuver around, they'd maneuver, they'd do their stuff, it might take weeks or months to get the armies in place. And then when those armies clash, they rip into each other, and it's going to be over in a couple of hours. It's actually amazing how conflicts between white men could be maneuvered in ancient times and even in closer times before war became industrial, and they could maneuver around, and then when they get stuck into each other, they have such a slaughter fest. But the incredible outcome is that within anything from 1 hour, 2 hours, or 8 hours, that the fate of a nation is totally changed. In other words, they get up in the morning and two nations or two empires seem to be equal in strength, and within 3 hours, 4 hours, or 8 hours, everything's changed. One is down, the other one's up. One is totally torn apart. Their army is shattered to pieces, it's game over, and the other one is out there and it's ripping up the last remnants of that army. And it happens with incredible speed. And this kind of stuff happened in the days of swords and spears, and it happened in the days of cannonballs. And we will revisit some of these things. So I just want to make it clear to you that when white men fought in the past, they didn't pussyfoot around. You think that because they were using swords, or because they were riding around on horses, or dragging some cannons around, you think that they were playing games. Let me tell you, those white men, when they got into the business of killing and fighting, they could outfight many modern armies in terms of casualties and the things that they could do. So anyway, returning to the Ukraine versus Russia, when I went and looked at how many men had died, as best I can guess, for a year, yes, the numbers that had died were pretty high, but believe it or not, if you had to look at those numbers as a percentage of the population of those nations, and remember, Ukraine is not just a little teeny-weeny, itsy-bitsy little nation. They've got a population of 44 million. And 44 million people can put up a fight, eh? 44 million white people can take lots of casualties. So yeah, the Russians might outnumber them 3-1, but don't think that the Ukrainians are just going to run out of men in 3 hours of fighting, okay? So I looked at those casualties, and yes, they were pretty high. They were pretty high, pretty hectic for modern times, but nothing untoward for the size of those nations. And it was clear to me that Ukraine still had a big manpower pool, okay? But here is Douglas McGregor telling you, the manpower pool is finished. It's finished. They're busy now picking up the last dregs of manpower because there are no men left because the Russians have killed them all. And that was the first red flag that went up, okay? Then I said to myself, I've looked at the numbers, I've looked at the ratios, and hold on. Douglas McGregor, you're now talking a bunch of shit, okay? And that was already a couple of months ago. 2 or 3 months ago, I was already looking at this and I was saying, you know what, Douglas McGregor, call it a day there, okay? Those numbers don't match the reality. There's stuff you're saying, you're talking up a storm, and that was the first big red flag. The next red flag that really had me with my jaw just like hitting the floor was when Douglas McGregor had the gumption to say that for every one Russian who gets killed, that 7 Ukrainians are getting killed. And I thought, hold on. That's the ratio that I've been looking at through the whole year and checking from time to time and looking to see if I can establish a number. And I'm saying that the ratio is more like 1 Ukrainian to 2 Russians, okay? Now you want to say that the Russians are killing 7 Ukrainians for the loss of 1 Russian? I'm looking at many factors, a lot of data coming in from the battlefields, and I know how these ratios work. And then Douglas McGregor's got the gumption to say, oh, you see, the Russians wanted to save people's lives, that's why they retreated. And I'm just saying, oh God, what kind of garbage is coming out of your mouth now? Nobody ever retreats. Nobody ever retreats in a war if there isn't a serious reason. People retreat in a war because somebody's smashing them in the face and they are retreating because they got to retreat or they're going to die. And Scott Ritter was saying, oh, well, you see, the Ukrainians just got very lucky in, you know, the month of September 2022. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell are you saying there? The Ukrainians got lucky? They got lucky? You mean like rolling a dice? This is warfare, okay? Warfare has got nothing to do with luck. It's got to do with skill. If the Ukrainians were pushing the Russians back, it's because the Ukrainians were fighting cleverer, fighting harder, and the Russians were fighting worse. You want to tell me that the Russians retreated from 50% of the territory that they captured in early 2022, that they retreated because they were feeling kind? They were feeling kind and they were feeling like they needed to give the other side a chance or something? Are you freaking nuts? So when I heard that kind of crap coming out of the mouths of Douglas McGregor and Scott Ritter, that's when I started losing all respect for these guys. Then I began to say to myself, are these guys totally bloody stupid? Or are these guys being paid by the Russians to say these things? Are these guys earning money in order to say this stuff? And quite frankly, I think there are only one of two options. Either Colonel Douglas McGregor and Scott Ritter are totally stupid and they seem to be totally incapable of assessing what is going on in the war, or these guys are being paid in order to say this stuff. They're being paid to say it. I cannot believe that they're just sucking up everything that they're being told and that they can't see the flaws in what they themselves are saying. Let's just take a quick look at things that you heard just a couple of minutes ago. So there was Scott Ritter saying that, the Russians are starting to get angry now. And previously the Russians used to go into the buildings and they used to fight floor by floor. And now the Russians are getting sick of it and the Russians are now just coming with a 1,500 kilogram bomb or whatever, and they're just dropping it on the building and they're just flattening the building and the building's just dropping and everybody is dying inside. I mean, when he starts saying things like, oh, the Russians are getting angry now. Hey, this is like, what, 15 months later? You want to tell me the Russians have been fighting a war for 15 months and they're only getting angry now? Like, what is this? Is this some kind of show on Broadway where suddenly you're now getting angry? Like, what the hell is war about? You know, is he saying that the Russians were just playing and toying around and they were just being nice and now they're really getting down to the business? It sounds more like somebody's talking about an actor on Broadway than about a soldier in battle, about generals and commanders in battle. Let me tell you, all generals, all commanders, all soldiers are doing what they can. Nobody is pussyfooting around. And don't believe this morality shit in war, okay? It shows you how short his memory is, and either, again, he's either completely stupid, or he can't even remember or didn't even know what was happening at the beginning of the war. Right in the beginning of the war, when the Russians were surrounding Kiev, they were bringing those nasty Russian tanks. The ones that have got thermobaric weapons. I'd been very interested in those tanks. Those tanks were coming and they were close, very close to Kiev. They were on the outskirts of Kiev. Those tanks have got thermobaric rockets that they fire. Those thermobaric rockets, a thermobaric weapon is also known as a fuel-air bomb, okay? It's like a shell that explodes in the air, but when it explodes, it puts out a fine mist of fuel, and then it ignites it, and it explodes almost like a miniature nuclear weapon. The Russians had thermobaric tanks, and they got those tanks close up to Kiev. Those thermobaric tanks are so potent that when they explode, they flatten buildings to the ground. And they had those things at Kiev already, right in the beginning of the war. And those tanks seem to have eventually quietly disappeared off the battlefield, whether they were retreated out from there. But we never again heard about these thermobaric tanks. These things were the closest thing to a nuclear weapon that the Russians had. And I was waiting for those thermobaric tanks to totally flatten Kiev and to totally flatten all other cities. And I don't hear much about those thermobaric weapons anymore. The only thing I discovered was that those thermobaric tanks have got a very short range of 6 miles or kilometers. I can't remember which. And so they have to come up real, real close. Now, whether those tanks have proven to be totally useless because they've got such a short range, or whether many of them have been destroyed, I don't know. But those weapons that looked like super weapons to me in the early days of the war, those weapons have very quietly faded away off the battlefield. You don't hear about them, you don't see them. And those weapons were designed for exactly that. They were there to smash everything into the ground. And the Russians have had that capability all through the war. And there are lots of places where they have already fought, where they did flatten literally every building there. So I don't know why Scott Ritter is now making a whole big story about it now, as if this is a new development, which it isn't. The Russians have had this capability and been using this capability as much as they can. So now he's making out like this is a new tactic and the Russians are going to do it. And the big problem with Scott Ritter and Colonel Douglas MacGregor is these guys are always talking up a storm, talking up a huge storm about how many victories the Russians are going to win. And then I look at the battlefield, I look at the maps, I look at the the battle lines, and I say to myself, well, if the Russians are this hot, if the Russians are this good, then why aren't they advancing? Why aren't they advancing? Why are they retreating so much? And earlier this year, I was waiting for the much vaunted, much talked up Russian offensive that Colonel Douglas McGregor was talking about. And if I need to, I will go and grab the video where Douglas McGregor said, it's all over. It's all over for Ukraine, okay? And Putin's going to unleash this offensive. And after this offensive, the next stop is Kiev, okay? Well, months later now, after this much vaunted offensive that was going to absolutely flatten the Ukrainians, we find that they've only advanced and managed to almost capture Bakhmut, okay? And that is what they've almost done, but in total it's taken them 11 months to capture a tiny little town that is the size of a town here in the Orange Free State here in South Africa, like Kronstadt, okay? You wouldn't imagine that the whole freaking Russian army would take 11 months to capture a tiny place like that. But that is the sad truth, which should show you very clearly that the Russians are not as hot as they are cracked up to be. I'm amazed that Scott Ritter and Colonel Douglas McGregor are still around, and it's May 2023, given the things that Douglas McGregor was saying just a couple of months ago, none of which came true, okay? His talk about, oh, they're going to advance on Kiev, next stop Kiev. Hey, none of that shit happened, okay? You know, when are these guys going to realize that their narrative versus the reality is very freaking different? I got to be honest with you. Either these guys are totally stupid, utterly brainwashed, or they're just paid shills, man. Maybe the Russians are just paying them a bunch of money to talk their shit, okay? Because that is what this is boiling down to. And I cannot take these guys seriously anymore. These guys are now devolving down to the level of the idiot Dr. Jordan Peterson, okay? Dr. Jordan Peterson is a moron, a total fool. He's anti-white. He's an Israel-loving, groveling, worthless piece of shit. And he's a German-hating piece of crap. And he tries to talk about every subject on the face of the earth. But in actual fact, he's a freaking moron and a stupid fool and a weak white man. He's another example of a waste of white skin, actually, this Jordan Peterson. And I've seen videos where this Jordan Peterson says, well, you know, Russia can't be beaten. Russia can't be beaten. They can never win. Russia is destined to win. Saying the same kind of crap as these guys. And by the way, Dr. Jordan Peterson, it turns out that he's actually a Soviet Union-loving white, and that he actually has got lots and lots of books and a deep interest in the time of the Soviet Union, Bolshevik Jewish Soviet Union. So he's an old commie lover, and here he is still believing that Russia is going to walk all over these people. I'm just amazed that Douglas McGregor and Scott Ritter can even show their faces after what they've said, that they actually have the impudence to even show their faces at this point in time, given what they've said. But all of this is about to change, okay? All of this is about to change, and all these clowns and idiots, this is about to change, and you're about to see something that's going to shock you. American politics might look like a total freaking clown show, and Western politics is a disgusting setup where the white men are as spineless as can be, but you're about to see a place where white men really rock. and that is in the military and in warfare. And you're going to see that while politics may be a total Jew cocksucking frenzy, the reality is that when white men are left to do their own thing in the military, in engineering, and in science, that when white men can think like white men and they solve problems, then you're going to see what white men can really do. And you're about to see that. If it's not been clear to you already, you're about to see it on a scale that's going to astound you. Warfare is not politics. Warfare is not about morality. Warfare is like engineering. Warfare is about what you can do. It's not about how you feel. It's about what you can do. And it amazes me that, what is it, 15 months into this conflict, that there are people who've actually watched the Russians being pushed back and the Russians losing big battles, the Battle of Kiev, the Battle of Kharkiv, that Putin went and said that Kherson is now a part of Russia, and just a couple of weeks later, Kherson became a part of Ukraine again. I mean, Putin's had egg on his face, the Russian army has lost endlessly, and it is only now that in this winter and in this early summer that these battle lines have stabilized. And now all these pro-Russian types think that this is a sign that the Russians are winning, when in fact the Russians are still unable to advance. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian offensive, we've not seen that yet, okay? But I've seen the previous Ukrainian offensives, and they impressed me. And I've seen some of the stuff that's happening, including the first preliminary moves. And I got to tell you, I'm impressed. So, let's do some proper analysis. And by the end of this video, when you ever again see stuff from Scott Ritter or Colonel Douglas McGregor, you'll just burst out laughing and you won't take these guys seriously ever again. Plus, you're going to see this stuff unfolding right before your eyes. And you're going to get some real respect for American and European weaponry, and for all military forces of the Western world. Politics may be a total clown show, with everyone busy sucking up to Jews and groveling in front of blacks, but when white men are allowed to be themselves, you'll see how freaking awesome they are. So first, let's take a quick look at history. You're about to see how important history is in predicting the future, and the things that you can learn from history, and why white men should study history very intensely. Now, when you get clowns coming and telling you that Russia cannot be defeated, it amazes me that these people can talk like this, and it shows that they don't know anything about warfare. They don't even know the history of Russia. Russia has suffered big defeats before, even in recent centuries, even when it was an empire. Two particular defeats that the Russians suffered are the Russo-Japanese War, which was just after 1900. The Russo-Japanese War, when Japan and Russia fought. Now, the big horror story of the Russo-Japanese War was that the Russian fleet was sunk in a couple of hours by the Japanese. It stunned Europe. They'd never seen a white fleet being sunk by non-whites before. The whole freaking fleet was at the bottom of the ocean in no time at all. And the Russians were not having it easy on the land either. Now, if you look on the screen in front of you, there's a photograph on the bottom left. And in that photograph, you're going to see a white man standing next to a cannon. That is an actual photograph from the 1850s. In the 1850s, Britain and France fought Russia in the Crimea. The British and the French fought the Russians in the Crimea, and the Russians were managing to hold out, and then the British and the French were going to get the Austrians to join. And when the Austrians said that they're going to join the war against Russia, the Russians called it quits. And that is how the Russians lost Crimea in the 1850s. And that's an actual photograph. There are lots of photographs from the Crimean War, real photographs from that time. So, can the Russians be defeated? Can the Russians be defeated in Crimea? You betcha. In fact, the British and the French fleets sailed into the Black Sea. So, the next image to look at in front of you, top right, you see Napoleon. And you see Napoleon lying on the ground, and you see Napoleon looking at a map. If you've ever read about Napoleon's life and Napoleon's campaigns, he was always carrying his maps with him. His maps were everything. And for Napoleon to jump out of his carriage and go and lie on the ground and open up his maps and study his maps, that was his internet and his PC of his time. And if you look at any military men, Hitler's generals, modern military men, you'll see one thing in common. They all have their maps. Whether the maps are on their screens or whether the maps are laid out on tables, but they've all got their maps and they're studying those maps. Those maps tell you many, many things. There are lots and lots of things that you can read from a map. A map is utterly critical in warfare, absolutely critical, even right now. And if Douglas MacGregor or Scott Ritter were serious, they'd be hauling out their maps and they'd be showing you stuff. They wouldn't be gesturing with their arms, they'd be hauling out maps. Now, in the top left, you see some vehicles. This is a photograph from World War II. See some German vehicles. And that man standing there in that vehicle, that's probably some kind of command vehicle or related to the command vehicles. That man standing there with binoculars in his hands. He is General von Manstein. General von Manstein was the guy who came up with the plan for how the Germans should defeat the French. And it was a fantastic plan and it worked like a charm. The next time that von Manstein got promoted and was actually given his first proper army, was when Hitler told him that he must go and conquer the Crimea. And von Manstein became the head of the 11th Army. It was his first ever full army that was his army. Unlike the British and the French in the Crimean War, von Manstein did not have any ships. Von Manstein had to conquer the Crimea from the land. And that's what we're going to be looking at because that is particularly difficult. A further problem that von Manstein had was that the Russians had lots of tanks and lots of good tanks. And the Russians had been building lots and lots and lots of defenses in the approaches to Crimea and for when you get into Crimea. And Sevastopol, which exists to this day, Sevastopol was an incredible fortress city. Von Manstein had to fight his way through the narrow entrance into Crimea. He then had to fight his way through lots and lots of defensive positions, and there was lots of Russian tanks there. And then eventually he had to get to Sevastopol, which is an insanely powerful city. It's a fortress city with enormous cannons and enormous walls. And this fortress city is on the edge of Crimea, and parts of the sides were sheer cliffs. And Manstein had to face that difficult fighting. And one of von Manstein's problems was Hitler did not give him much in the way of armor. So Manstein had an infantry army, hardly any armor. The Russians had lots and lots of tanks, and the Russian Air Force had total air superiority. Total air superiority. They could fly anywhere they wanted to. They could attack the Germans any time at all. So with this tiny army that was ill-equipped and had to face tremendous defenses, tanks, as well as a superior enemy air force, General von Manstein and the 11th Army, despite incredible hardships and long fighting, that man that you see there, he conquered the whole of the Crimea. It is probably the most difficult campaign ever fought in the Crimea, ever. And that man that you see there, that German, he pulled it off. The situation today that is being faced is much, much easier than what von Manstein and the Germans had to do. Von Manstein was incredibly clever, and Manstein had a plan for every occasion. And that man had no shortage of ideas. Between him and his German troops, they freaking did incredible things that would really normally just be considered plain impossible. Von Manstein survived attacks from the Russian Air Force by taking his vehicles and digging them into the ground. They had to dig big freaking holes and put their vehicles into those holes so as to try and protect them from the Russian Air Force. Manstein had no tanks, so he took all kinds of hodgepodge vehicles, including armored cars and all kinds of bits and pieces, and he had to kind of invent like a miniature kind of a hodgepodge little semi-tank force that can help him to fight real actual deadly tanks. What Manstein did in the Crimea was just freaking amazing. Hitler gave him a tremendous award when he won, and Hitler really praised him to high heaven. All of Germany was informed by Hitler of the amazing feat that Manstein had pulled off with his little hodgepodge 11th Army. The only heavy weaponry that they got to help them were those enormous guns that come on trains. And to just give you another idea of how insanely difficult this was, at a point, Manstein was on a boat, and Manstein looked at the sheer cliffs, the cliffs that came straight out of the sea and went straight up to tremendous heights. And Manstein looked at those cliffs, and then he went back and he said to his soldiers, "Do you guys think you can climb those cliffs from the sea?" And those German soldiers, they did. They did. They said they would, and he prepared forces, and despite being shot at while they were crossing with the boats, they physically climbed up sheer cliffs to fight the Russians at the top. That was just among the incredible, insane stuff that those Germans did. So when you see that picture there, you're looking at an incredible man who commanded incredible men who did impossible things. And there's a saying from Napoleon that impossible is a word that you only find in the dictionary of fools. So Napoleon and Manstein, they did the impossible, not just once, over and over and over again. They were supermen. Finally, I want you to take a look at the guy in the bottom right. The man in the bottom right, King Frederick the Great, Hitler's greatest hero, Frederick the Great. And here is something that Frederick the Great said. This is part of his writings that he wrote, because he wrote a whole history of all his wars, and he also wrote manuals for his generals. And this is what King Frederick the Great wrote. He wrote, "By attacking in the flank, an army of 30,000 men might defeat an army of 100,000 men." By attacking in the flank being the side, by attacking in the flank, an army of 30,000 men might defeat an army of 100,000 men. One thing about all these military men, all of them, from the past and even the current ones, white men are cold-blooded killers. White men are cold-blooded and they number crunch and they work out how to kill their enemies. And they are very cold-blooded. So keep this quote from Frederick the Great in mind, because I'm going to show you some stuff on some maps shortly. The next video that you're going to see is a short video. It's from Sky News in Britain. You're going to see them talking to a man called an Air Vice Marshal. An Air Vice Marshal is a term that Americans and other whites might not be familiar with, but that is a British term, and it is a term, a rank for a man in the British Air Force. An Air Vice Marshal is the same as a Major General in the Army or a Rear Admiral in the Navy. So in other words, this guy is an Air Force guy, but he's basically the same rank as a general. I like this guy a lot. He's very intelligent, very clever, and he does some excellent analyses. So in this short video, you're going to see a couple of things. So we're going to move away from arm waving, and what we're going to do is we're going to see real things. And the first story is a very important story. It is about the Ukrainians all of a sudden using drones, and they blow up a massive fuel storage depot in the center of Crimea. And they've probably destroyed 40,000 tons of fuel that the Russian army needed. If you listen very carefully, he will also tell you that there's an enormous depot where the Russians had all their armored vehicles in Crimea. They emptied it out. They moved all the armored vehicles out. Why? Because they've moved them out to the front lines everywhere. They know a storm is coming. And despite guys like Scott Ritter and Douglas McGregor, the Russians know pain is coming soon. Then he's going to tell you a bunch of stuff about the coming offensive. But I want you to take special note of the map right at the end, where he starts talking about places that the Ukrainians can attack and should attack, and places where they won't be able to attack. Take special note of what he says there. Take special note. We'll be discussing it shortly.
I'm joined now by military analyst, retired Air Vice Marshal Sean Bell. Good to see you, Sean. So what is the latest on this huge explosion in Crimea, and how much damage has it done?
It was an explosion in the port of Sevastopol, home of the Black Sea Fleet. The tanks, the Russians claim that 4 tanks were destroyed. In fact, it looks like 10 vast storage facilities for fuel oil, and potentially up to 40,000 tonnes of fuel oil was destroyed. Today, although this happened yesterday morning, today it's all under control, but the Russians have claimed that Ukrainians actually did a drone strike which caused this, and they said it was mounted from Odessa, which is 250 kilometres away. That's a long way away for the drones to come. They've also claimed it was the Mugin 5 drones shown here. These are 25-kilogram warheads. They're about 5 metres wide, three metres long. They've got a payload of about 25 kilograms, and they fly about 100 miles an hour. They only cost about £10,000. They're sourced in China, which seems a bit strange. And the one thing about this story which doesn't quite add up is that the Russians have been using these drones against the Ukrainians. So we're not quite sure at the moment whether this was actually the drone being used, but that's what the Russians have claimed. Now, individually, these are very vulnerable. But if you put them as a swarm of drones, and it looks like the Ukrainians have used 10 at a time, so the Russians managed, air defences managed to take out some of them, two managed to get through. And as you see, it's the danger of having these sorts of large quantity drones that are relatively cheap and cheerful, individually not very effective, collectively can be very dangerous.
Right. Now, it's interesting that Ukraine hasn't claimed responsibility for this attack. You know, one would assume that Russia, wouldn't be targeting their own critical infrastructure either. Nevertheless, we are awaiting this spring offensive. Could this be the beginning of the opening salvo?
One of the things about this spring offensive, much vaunted, it won't start with a fanfare of trumpets and, you know, we're off. It will almost certainly be a phased approach. And the first phase will be Ukrainians taking out lots of Russia's logistics support and things like the fuel. Where will that offensive happen? Three main areas, possibly up into the Donbass region. The trouble is there's been fierce fighting going on there, and actually it'll be very difficult to reverse that quickly. The Crimea, the trouble is that's massively reinforced. It'll be very difficult for Ukraine to make progress there. So almost certainly it's going to be this land bridge area here where the main focus of the attack's likely to be. If Ukraine's going to be successful in these troops and equipment, 14,000 troops that have been trained in the UK have now found their way back to Ukraine. They're ready to go. And that's just the UK. Lots of international partners have also done training. And on the equipment front, NATO Secretary General said on Thursday that 98% of the equipment that had been promised to Ukrainians has now been delivered. So that's 1,500 armoured personnel carriers, it's 230 tanks and vast quantities of ammunition. It does look like Ukrainian preparations are almost complete for that offensive.
Right. And as we know, Ukraine remains very, very tight-lipped about their operational plans. Nevertheless, as you say, they are preparing for this offensive. What do we know about how Russia's preparing for this offensive?
The one thing that they're not doing, preparing at the moment, is around Bakhmut, because the fighting there, there's still intense fighting. Russians still grinding on. We've been talking about that for 11 months. The Russians control about 87% of Bakhmut now. But away from that, it's pretty evident Russia are very nervous about what Ukraine's going to do. After all, Russia's already lost 50% of the territory that it had taken at one stage in this war. If we look at it in Crimea, there's a vast equipment storage area in Crimea. Over the last few days, that has been emptied of armoured personnel, vehicles and tanks, completely emptied and redeployed. Zaporizhzhia nuclear facility, there's emplacements, actually. The Russians are putting sandbags in, reinforcing there, really worrying, because that's within the nuclear facility. They're expecting to fight there. It's worth pointing out the reactor is actually very well hardened, it's fine. So the east of Zaporizhzhia, 120 kilometres of trenches, some of them visible from space, but also these dragon's teeth, which we haven't actually seen since the Second World War. They're 1 metre tall, they are a pyramid in function, and they're made of concrete. They're just designed to slow down main battle tanks, and they're being used all over the place. This is old footage from last year, but it still shows the value. I mean, the very fact that we've not been talking about the war in Ukraine for the last week doesn't mean there's not a lot going on behind the scenes, and there's definitely a storm brewing.
OK, Sean, always good to see you. Thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
Now I'm going to show you a very short video. This is just a little summary that comes out of another video. It's from a channel called Binkov's Battlegrounds, and they do some serious analysis. And it's actually Russians doing serious analysis. I don't know if these are Russians in America or Russians in Russia. But anyway, they do some good stuff, and just watch this little piece of video footage. It is only about 47 seconds long. And in this, it's going to show you how the Ukrainians can take Crimea. And watch the way that the guy analyzes it. And watch how he points you to saying that the only way that you can take Crimea is via Zaporizhia. Watch that map carefully.
To retake Crimea, Ukraine must at least secure the Kherson region first. This is because it provides a land connection from which it can launch an offensive and supply it from. But in order to do that, it would also first need to retake a better part of the Zaporizhia region. That would reduce Russia's ability to strike Ukrainian supply lines passing through Kherson region, and would provide a buffer region if Russia were to attempt an offensive to cut off or prevent a Ukrainian invasion of Crimea. Crucially, it would severely limit Russian-owned supplies to Crimea. Now, taking those two regions are huge operations in themselves, and they might take months or years once they begin.
Okay, now that you've seen other people's analyses, take a look at the map that's on the screen there. You are going to see lots of green arrows, and I've named them using alphabetic characters. So it's A, B, C, etc. We're going to start discussing this thing. So let's go back to Binkov's Battlegrounds. They're actually a serious website with a big following. And Binkov's Battlegrounds gave you a whole long story about why you need to attack through Zaporizhia on a big front and capture tons and tons of territory and then eventually maneuver around to get into Crimea. Everything you saw on that map and what they showed you there, that's all total bullshit, okay? It's total horseshit. Every reason that they gave you for why they have to do it that way is total crap, okay? So everything that came out of Binkov's Battlegrounds is total horseshit, and no general who's worth anything would ever do anything like that. That is just incredibly bloated, total wastage. It is hideous. If that's how you ran an army, you'd be a total moron. And then they go on to say this could take months or maybe even years. What a load of crap, okay? What a total load of crap. Everything you saw and heard from Binkov's Battlegrounds, total horseshit, okay? Total horseshit. So, you've just been fooled. In the case of Binkov's Battlegrounds, maybe those guys are truly that freaking stupid, okay? So, that is a possibility. That's a very real possibility. Now, how do I know that you don't have to do all that hectic stuff? Well, that is because General von Manstein didn't have to do that. General von Manstein fought his way into Crimea. And if you look on the map in front of you, von Manstein basically came along the arrow that is labeled G. He basically fought his way in from G to H and then along I. That is how he got into Crimea. He went through the narrow, horrible part, the part that you're being told is impossible to go through. Now, what about the Air Vice Marshal? Now, that's a different story. The Air Vice Marshal is a professional, and he's not going to go onto TV and start giving away what's going on. Even if he doesn't know the secrets, and it's very likely he has no idea what the official possibilities are, even if he doesn't know that, that man is more than intelligent enough to give you a very detailed discussion about why you could consider attacking from Kherson into Crimea, in other words, along G. He could easily have given you reasons and discussions in more detail if he'd wanted to. But I think that he suspects his own things, and I think that this was just some sleight of hand. He's like a magician, and he doesn't want to draw your attention too much in the wrong place. And in actual fact, if you look at what all the commentators have been saying for months and months and months, they've all been talking about Zaporizhia. In other words, if you look on the map there, then you'll see I've got an arrow labeled B and an arrow labeled C, and C is the closest to Zaporizhia. Zaporizhia lies between B and C. All the commentators are talking about that area. So let's start at the top and let's work our way down through these arrows because I want to discuss them. So for example, arrow A. What if the Ukrainians launched an attack along arrow A? Arrow A would enable them to get into an area. If you look closely there, you'll see there's an area with a bunch of roads, a bunch of major roads that come together. So that could have been a possible line of attack, for example. And that is like one theoretical place you could have just gone. And at best, you could have managed to get to places where there are lots of roads and you could have started cutting off supply lines for the Russians. So you could have had some kind of effect there. But other than that, it doesn't really have much value. So A would have been generally a useless choice to attack along. So what about, let's say, an attack along line B? Well, the nice thing about B is that the goal is Mariupol. And when I first looked at these maps, I actually liked this idea of going for Mariupol. Because it doesn't quite show it here, but there's also another road that's very close to that line B. And if you can get to Mariupol, you not only get a city, but you also cut off all the supply lines of the Russians. So if you get to Mariupol, the distance isn't that great, and you can actually slice through there and cut off the supply lines from Russia. And that would definitely have an effect on all the places to the west or the left of that line. So I quite liked Mariupol as a possible target, because it cuts off the Russian supplies, or most of the Russian supplies, especially all the ones that are coming through that region, and it would starve other units to the left of line B. So I quite like that. Then there is C. C is the closest one to the Zaporizhia area. And if you attacked along there, you'd get to a place called Melitopol, and that looks like that is a city, and that could be a good target to go for, plus you can start cutting off lines of communication. But the real problem with these areas from C to B is that you are now attacking straight into the very area where the enemy has been preparing to defend. So you are now going into the area where there are trenches, where there are bunkers, where there are dragon's teeth. So why would you want to attack in the very place where they are waiting to kill you. Why would you want to do that? And the answer is that you really would not normally want to do that. You'd only do that if you didn't have other options. So if the Russians have been building lots and lots of defenses, especially in Zaporizhia, why would you really want to go there? And the answer is that any soldier or commander would immediately ask himself the question, aren't there other ways we could do this? So far, out of A, B, and C, the only thing that really would have value and that would probably be the easiest to get is Mariupol. It's a smallish town or city, and the distance to it is not that great. And in warfare, moving around in warfare is like moving through mud, and it's slow, and it's tedious. So in warfare, you try to move in straight lines, and you try to move in short distances. One of the problems of doing things like A, B, and C is that if you cut through the lines and you're moving towards your target, you now have a corridor that you have to defend, and you've got troops on either side of that corridor. So now you're attacking, and other troops and reinforcements can come at you from both the east and the west. So that's a negative. So let's go and look at another possibility, and the possibility is Kherson. They say that you can't attack from Kherson. This is G, that you can't attack from Kherson. Why? Because apparently there are lakes and marshes and lots and lots and lots of defenses. I do find it hard to believe that there could be more defenses there now than there were in World War II. You just cannot compare the intensity of World War II to this modern stuff. The Russians had huge numbers of tanks hiding inside Crimea. They had tons and tons of defensive lines. And yet that very narrow area is the exact area that the Germans came through. So if the Germans could get through with an under-equipped army facing very superior firepower from inside Crimea, why the hell can't the Ukrainians do it now? Aren't there any possible benefits to fighting along the line of G? Well, one of the benefits of fighting along G is that there can't be that many Russians to the west of G. And if there are any, they can't be reinforced. So if you're really coming from G, what is nice is you mostly have to move forward, and you can only really be hit from line D. If you look at D, that comes from Melitopol, that is the only place from which they could try to hit you. But otherwise, your one flank, the flank that's facing the Black Sea, that flank would actually be pretty okay. It would be easy to defend. And if the Russians have got massive, massive trench systems in Zaporizhia, how bad is it really when you go from Kherson down to H, from G down to H? Even if the Russians have got lots and lots of defenses that they've built there, including bunkers and all kinds of things, the fact of the matter is that you wouldn't need to move in a very broad area. You'd move with a narrow column, and you wouldn't have to fight over such a wide area. And that would also give you a benefit as well. So yes, the defender will have a benefit, but you also will have a benefit in that you don't have to fight along a very broad front. And if you look very closely at the map, there where it says H, look at where the Crimea joins the mainland. You'll see that there are lakes. You'll see those shaded areas are lakes and marshes. If you look very, very carefully, you'll see that there's a narrow entrance. There is a narrow entrance there where G meets H. So there is a place where you can get in that is in between the lakes. And in more detailed close-up maps, it turns out that there from I, I've got a little arrow, a short arrow from I that points to E, that there is actually also another roadway that actually winds its way from I to E. So there are narrow roadways that can get into and out of that area. Another thing that I know from the time of Manstein is that once you actually get into Crimea, the land is actually flat. The land is flat and it's actually suitable for armor. And it's actually quite okay until you get closer to the coast again. So while the approaches may look pretty hectic, the fact of the matter is that it's actually not a bad approach. So let me tell you what I think is going on. I think that all these commentators who are talking about Zaporizhia, that they may have been instructed to talk about Zaporizhia, or the information that they were given was given in such a way as to mislead them. And that is why all the commentators keep saying Zaporizhia, Zaporizhia, Zaporizhia. Last year, when the Ukrainians were busy with their offensives, they fooled everybody by talking for months on end about Kherson. They spoke about the southern offensive. That's what they called it. They called it the southern offensive. And for months, everybody was fooled. I was fooled for months. And I kept saying, when the hell are these Ukrainians going to get down to Kherson? Meanwhile, I see they're fighting up there by Kharkiv, and they're doing other things there near Luhansk. And I can't understand, when is this stupid southern offensive going to get off the ground? Meanwhile, the southern offensive was the deception. The southern offensive was the deception, and everybody kept repeating the deception over and over again for months. And then when the Ukrainians had captured everything else, then suddenly, when you no longer expected it, that's when they went and grabbed Kherson. So the southern offensive was the deception. And how do you know that Zaporizhia isn't the current deception? And the more I look at this, the more I'm telling you, not only is Zaporizhia the current deception, but the deception was so good that the Russians believe it, that the Russian army believes it. Now, we've seen tank forces do clever things before. Where did we see it? We saw it in France in World War II. The French had the Maginot Line. The French were also waiting for the Germans to come via Belgium. And so the French said, we got the Maginot Line between us and Germany. We've got the Belgian front covered. We've got all the sides covered. And then what happened? Then the panzers came out through the Ardennes forest. That is where Manstein and Guderian had looked at it, and they'd said that the panzers can maybe hit the French from that position. It was Manstein who asked Guderian, whether the panzers would be able to physically move through a dense forest, a huge dense forest. And Guderian came back and said to him, yes, it's possible. So the French had all the lines covered, and then they got clobbered from an angle that they never expected, that the German tanks would emerge from a freaking forest on their flank. Remember what King Frederick the Great said about a flank attack? If you attack an army in the flank, 30,000 men might be able to defeat 100,000 men. That's exactly what the Germans did. And the Germans not only did that, but they did it by bringing panzers through a freaking dense, huge forest. A place that is not suitable for tanks. And it's a large number of tanks they were bringing. Now, in this modern time, we don't have that kind of density of warfare. So, according to that Air Vice Marshal, the Ukrainians have got 230 tanks and 1,500 armored vehicles. These are infantry fighting vehicles. They've got 9 brigades, totaling about 40,000 troops. So let me explain to you what I think good generals would do. Here's what I think Manstein or Napoleon or Frederick the Great would do if they had to face this situation. And you can see and compare it with what actually happens in the coming months. But here's what I think a guy like Manstein would do. And another thing, I've brought up the issue of strategy versus tactics many times. And I've explained that when you've got two sides and the one side is far better quality than the other side, that the side that's got better quality can start doing all kinds of things that you would think are impossible. And the side that's got lower quality, they can't even do the most basic things. And what we've got on the battlefield in Ukraine is quality versus quantity. And the quality are the Ukrainians with their soldiers as well as their weapons. And the quantity, the lower quality, are the Russians. They've got large numbers and not such good equipment. And the Ukrainians have now fought for close to 15 months. They've got battle experience. They've got lots of battle experience now. So let me show you what is possible. So the first thing is, I think that the Russians and everybody has been conned by this Zaporizhia story. And that even the Russian army and the Russians have fallen for this stupid idea. Because they believe that it's not possible for anything else major to occur. So any army that is now going to do this thing could reinforce this by playing dumb. So out of those 9 brigades, what the Ukrainians could do is the Ukrainians could take 1 or 2 brigades and use them at either B or C on the map there. They could take 1 or 2 brigades and use them at B or C. So after these Ukrainians start hitting all these logistical things with artillery and rockets and drones, then shortly thereafter, they could come with 1 or 2 brigades of their armor, and they could pick an area, and they could launch an attack. Let's say at B, for example, or even C. And they launch an attack, and they start attacking in that direction. The Russians are ready for them. The Russians give them a hard time, and they're battling. and they're not really moving forward much. But when the Russians see them attacking there, then the Russians will be saying to themselves, yes, yes, this is the offensive. This is where they're attacking. This is where they're attacking. We need to bring in more reinforcements. We've got to concentrate more here. This is where we can stop them. We can stop them the way that they stopped us at Bakhmut, okay? So then the Russian attention is drawn to that area. And the Russians are focusing their energy on that area. But an army that is really up on its game could then do something very, very strange that you would not expect. Because warfare can be like a magic show. It can be like a magic act. Secrecy done properly can be like a magic act. Now, one of the shocking things that I picked up the other day from one of the generals is that right throughout the war, that most of the supplies that have been coming into Ukraine have come from Poland, and that it's coming via railway and it's coming via big convoys on roads. And apparently, during the entire war, the Russians have never yet once, not even once, destroyed a train or a railway line to stop the supplies coming through. They've not managed to destroy either a train or a railway line or destroy a convoy. Now, I thought that the Russian cruise missiles were absolutely perfect for that kind of thing. That the Russians have the ability to target long distances away. And I would have thought that that would have been the perfect thing for the Russians to do. Well, apparently it's never happened. So that's very bad news. But an army like the Ukrainians that functions in total secrecy is capable of some very interesting stuff. So let's say one or two brigades are attacking somewhere there by B or C. The other seven brigades could be quietly moved either at night or in various ways, moved and hidden, and brought carefully along this line F. They could very quietly bring all the other seven brigades via F to Kherson. They could bring their entire army, they could bring the other 35,000 troops with their armored vehicles. Let's say they travel at night and they hide in the day and that kind of thing. They could bring their entire army into Kherson and regions near Kherson and hide the entire army. So while the other two brigades start fighting there, the Russians are saying, yeah, yeah, this is the offensive. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian army is hiding here by Kherson. And Ukrainian troops have already crossed the Dnieper River. They have already crossed the Dnieper River by Kherson. And they can already be preparing and scouting their way forward so that they know everything that's going on. And once the Ukrainian army thinks that they have got the Russians nicely focused and they've destroyed all the logistics that they need to destroy, they can unleash those seven brigades. Those seven brigades can cross the bridges, drive over there, and get into this area. Now, previously, I would have thought that the bridges could have been destroyed or that sort of thing, but the Russians truly are showing that they aren't capable of these kinds of things. The Russians could already have destroyed the bridges that are going over that river, and apparently that's not happened. So I think that the Ukrainian army will be able to easily move all those brigades across that river and start attacking down in the direction of G. And then, in order to defend their flank, there's another road that goes, if you look from G to D, there's actually another road that goes along that line, and that would be an area that the Russians could send reinforcements from to attack them in the flank. So the Russians could attack along D. But if the Ukrainians are pouring over the Dnieper, they can send, let's say, one or two brigades in the direction of D so that they can protect the flank. They can fight their way forward and protect the flank. And if you look there, I drew a line at J. So what you could do is the bulk of the army can fight along G towards H, then another brigade or two could fight along the line that takes them in the direction of D, and the goal there is to eventually build a line along J. And the rest of their armor, the rest of their heavy armor, in other words, the bulk of their armored forces, can all focus their energy on G to H to fight along that direction, along with artillery, along with drones, etc., fight along the line from G to H and fight their way into Crimea. The distance is short. So the distance is short, that's good, and the Ukrainians could get artillery support and rocket support, maybe even some aerial support as well. And all they have to focus on is fighting down G and try and reach J as well. So they've just got a little triangular area to go through, and of course then they've got to fight through the hard stuff at that very narrow point there. But given the kinds of weaponry that they've got, I can't see that as a problem. They can bring in all their best HIMARS and artillery stuff and pound the living hell out of those narrow spaces. I don't think that those narrow spaces are going to be that much of a problem for them. And given their tremendous armor that they've got, because the armored force that they've got is more than twice the size of the armor that I expected them to get for the whole year. Their armored force is enormous, actually. It's more than twice the size of what was expected for the whole year. So they got lots of tanks and they got tons of support vehicles with troops. These guys have got a serious, serious armored force here. This is an incredible force, and it's got all the weaponry, plus it's got artillery and rockets that are going to be able to support it. It's not a long distance, man. And narrow spaces, it's going to work both ways, man. So they only have to capture a tiny little area, block it off, and then fight, do all the heavy fighting into H. But they're going to have lots of brigades that can do it. So even if they use one or two brigades up there as a diversion, even if they use another one or two brigades there to go and create a flank for themselves at J, they've still got another five brigades that can focus all their energy on G to H. And if they reach a point where they decide that, you know what, there's no more need to put pressure up there, they could relocate those brigades back through Kherson and bring them back to support the others. They don't have a need for those brigades to actually hold those lines because they're already holding those lines. Once the deception is over, then they can withdraw them from the battle and those lines will still be intact, and they just ship them over to Kherson and bring them in as reserves to come back down through G to help the others. So I really don't see that this is going to be such a problem. And once they get through to H, then it's game over, man. And if you listened carefully, the Air Vice Marshal said that there was a huge depot of armored vehicles inside Crimea, and that the Russians had removed all the armored vehicles from Crimea and were using it everywhere else. So that basically means that Crimea is empty, that they only have their basic defenses here, and that the rest of the armor, that the rest of the armor has already been moved out of Crimea. So when the Ukrainian armor smashes through from G to H, there's going to be no other armored opposition here. And the terrain is flat. A lot of the terrain around H and I is flat. So their armor is going to have a field day. They'll be able to blast out in different directions down to Sevastopol. They can go to K, which leads to the Kerch Bridge. The Kerch Bridge is the only other thing that connects to Russia. They can go and block this area here. It's a narrow area here by K. Oh man, once they bust through G and H, they're going to have a field day. And they've got enough armor of all kinds that they'll be able to go in all different directions, grab everything. They'll even be able to block possible attacks from E. And the only places that the Russians will be able to fight them from will be D and E. And whatever few troops are left here inside Crimea, the Ukrainians are going to have a freaking field day. And they can even go all the way to the Kerch Bridge and block off any supplies coming in from Russia. And Crimea will be theirs. And let me tell you what the clincher is regarding Crimea. Is, I did not know this, but Crimea is a very, very strategic area. Of all the pieces of territory that the Russians have in Ukraine, Crimea is the most important. Crimea is like the diamond in the crown. It turns out that Crimea is so strategically important that the Russian Navy and the Russians are able to use Crimea to block Ukraine's exports. It turns out that Crimea is the main thing that is hammering the Ukrainian economy. And if the Ukrainians capture Crimea, the Russian fleet will have to leave. It'll be a total game changer. So in other words, out of all of these places where the Ukrainian army can strike, the place that is the most valuable for Ukraine, for helping Ukraine, is to get Crimea. If they can get Crimea, it is a game changer. It is going to massively change the game. It's going to allow them to open up their economy, and it's going to sort out all the threats, all the seagoing threats and advantages that the Russians have. All the naval advantages that the Russians have will disappear when the Ukrainians get Crimea. That is why Crimea is far more important than Luhansk and all these other places. All these other places are of minor importance. Crimea is everything. Crimea is a game changer. And it may even allow them to harass the Russians, because the Russians are then bottled up in the Sea of Azov. And they can go and blow up the Kerch Bridge, and then the Russians can't get into Crimea. And for the Ukrainians to get Crimea, all the Ukrainians have to do is fight along G and H, get into Crimea, seize Crimea, and all that they have to do to block the Russians from retaking Crimea is to be able to block attacks along the lines D and E. They can block the Kerch Bridge by just blowing the freaking thing up, and then all they have to do is defend attacks from D and E. They actually only need to have a line there by J, because most of the other places are lakes, and the narrow places they can defend themselves. And the Ukrainians have shown themselves to be capable of defense to a tremendous degree. They are actually better at defending than the Russians. The Russians, with their entire offensive, have not been able to move forward at all, except in Bakhmut. And it's taken them 11 months of incredible slaughter to just advance short distances into Bakhmut. So for the Ukrainians, can that huge armored force of the Ukrainians come in secretly through Kherson, launch an attack, smash down through G and H, seize Crimea, block along the line J, and Bob's your uncle. Bob's your uncle. Crimea's gone, baby. Crimea is gone. The most important thing that the Russians have would be gone, and it will be easy. Their main fighting is going to be G to H and blocking the line by J. Everything else is going to be a piece of cake, and they've got the vehicles, the kind of weaponry they need, and the speed. The Russians won't know what hit them. And it's actually very fascinating that the Russian army is itself dependent upon lots of supplies that are sitting in Crimea. So now all the Russian supplies have to come via Mariupol, Berdyansk, etc. So it doesn't matter what the Russians have done at Zaporizhia. Even if all the defenses that have been set up along the line G and H are as difficult or even somewhat more difficult than Zaporizhia, the fact is it's a narrow front. They bring in all those weapons, they go and they smack along that line, and it can be a game changer. It'll be almost like checkmate in a chess game. It'll be very close. And let me tell you something. I've come to the conclusion that whenever the Jew Zelensky goes to America and he asks for this and he asks for that, that in actual fact what's happening is the United States Army is looking at this stuff, and the US military analyzes it, and the US military says what they will and won't give. For example, Zelensky has asked for hundreds of jet aircraft, and the Americans have consistently said no. And I now understand the reasons why they're not wasting their money on the jets. They have actually clearly looked at the battlefield conditions and done their analyses and realized that all that the Ukrainians really need is a real armored fist. Use an armored fist, smash through the Russian lines, and you'll get what you want. You won't need to have hundreds of jets as well. You don't need that. The other stuff is good enough. I'm absolutely convinced that the Americans have wargamed this. The Americans, the Germans, everybody knows this. They've looked at it and that they've said, okay, we give you the tanks and the armored vehicles. This will be enough. This will do the job. They all know the amount of fighting that has to be done. Make no mistake, they've given them the right quantities, and these guys are not going to have a shortfall. They've been trained and they've got enough weapons. The weapons are good enough. The troops are good enough. They've been training for months and months and months in these combined arms tactics. They've got lovely backup artillery as well as HIMARS. HIMARS is deadly, plus some drones. The Ukrainians have got the right army needed for the job. And when this thing is over, the Russians are going to lose the most important thing that they have. Crimea. The thing they had the longest and the most critical thing of all. All these other chunks of territory are not that critical to the Ukrainians at this point in time. If they nail Crimea, then the Russian fleet is out of action. The Ukrainians can open up the port of Odessa. The Ukrainians will be able to do all their shipping without any hassle from the Russians. Another area where I thought the Russians had totally flattened the Ukrainians was with the economy. My understanding is that only a third of the Ukrainian economy has been knocked out, and that two-thirds of the Ukrainian economy is still functioning. So if two-thirds of the Ukrainian economy is functioning, and they seize Crimea, and they open up their ports, and they can start doing lots of things again, then the Ukrainian economy is going to be recovering quickly. The armored forces can rest. They only have to defend against attacks from D and E. The Kerch Bridge will be quite safe. Kerch Bridge sorted out. Russians won't be able to touch them. They only have to care about D and E. The Russians, meanwhile, will now have to ensure that all their supplies are coming through Mariupol. And it gives the Ukrainians a chance to rest. Depending on their power and their speed, they can start trying to roll up the Russians by counterattacking in the direction against Melitopol. And we see how far they can go in this summer. But even if for the summer, even if they only capture Crimea, it's a total game changer, then they can rest and prepare for next year. And next year they can drive the Russians out everywhere else. I must tell you that I think Crimea will be a huge disaster for the Russians, the loss of Crimea. And I must tell you that if the Ukrainians do this with their tanks, that the Russians might not be very keen at all to fight them anymore. I think most of those Russian men are really not going to be keen to fight. And it's going to leave Putin with huge problems. So I think Crimea alone will be a huge game changer. Huge game changer. And then consider, for example, next year. All that the Ukrainians have to do is then they can pick another area. Because with the Russians now, let's say close to Crimea, let's say by Line J, stretching all the way back to Luhansk, all that the Ukrainians have to do is they can then come back, let's say next year, and launch a strike down B. They launch a strike at B and they hit Mariupol. If they do that, then they've captured half of the Russian army. All they have to do is launch a strike along B, capture Mariupol, cut a corridor for themselves, and they'll have half of the Russian army captured. Half of it captured. And it will not be able to get supplies. Then that will be another enormous disaster. So I honestly tell you that when I look at this thing, I think that it's even possible that the Ukrainians will do better than just getting Crimea. That might well be possible. But even if they just do Crimea alone, the Russians are totally screwed. Then the Russians have lost the most important thing they had. And the Ukrainian economy is going to recover. Ukrainians will be able to be stronger by next year. So this is the beginning of the end for the Russians. This is the beginning of the end for the Russians. The Russians could be out of here in 2 years. But it all depends on how good the armor goes. Maybe the armor is even better than this. Maybe the armor can do much more than just Crimea. Imagine if the armor really could capture Crimea and slice through to Mariupol. If it could do both, oh God, what a disaster it would be. Probably two-thirds of the Russians would be trapped. But I wouldn't want to put my money on that one. But I think Crimea, definitely doable. Definitely doable. I think Crimea is a given. And I think that's the nightmare that we're going to see unfolding for the Russians. So, you've learned some things. Let's now see how the reality pans out. It's going to be a very interesting summer. But I must tell you that for the Russians, I think the Russians are going to be out of Ukraine within 2 years. By the time Americans go to elect a president, there aren't going to be any Russians left in Ukraine. The Russians will be real tired and they will have suffered a lot of pain.
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.